I saw two bumper stickers just yesterday. Oddly enough, a coincidence, I think, with our conversation here on Just War. One of the bumper stickers said, "War is never the answer." The other one said, and I don't know, these were two completely unrelated cars. The other bumper sticker said, "If war is the answer, we're asking the wrong question. Is there such a thing as just war? What about the war that we're engaged in now as a nation, the war in Iraq that continues so far away? Is this a just war? Is the whole idea of just war just a justification for war?" Here in this hour of Issues Etc., we're going to be talking about just war. Dr. Daryl Charles joins us in just a moment. If you'd like to join us, your questions and comments, 1-800-730-2727, 1-800-730-2727, and our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Dr. Charles is a regular guest. He's Associate Professor of Religion and Ethics at Union University in Jackson, Tennessee, and author of several books, including his latest, Between Pacifism and Jihad, Just War and Christian Tradition. Dr. Daryl Charles, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thanks, Todd. It's a delight to be with you again.
Well, let's address the question of just war to the war that we are presently engaged in, the war in Iraq. Is the Iraqi war a just war?
First of all, let me preface my response by saying that the book was not written as a response to Iraq or as an apologetic for the current administration. Many people will assume that, probably. Iraq has come and gone twice, has it not, 91 and 2003. What will be the next, and by what criteria will we distinguish between justice and injustice, consider egregious human rights violations, deal with or confront genocide, the broader question whether the West, an American culture specifically since we have an American audience, is willing to make moral judgments, the answer to that, the verdict is out at anyway. Is the war in Iraq justified? I prefer to use the word justified in the book, and I think consonant with the Christian tradition, and we're speaking really of a tradition that's the better part of two millennia, it's perhaps most accurate to speak of justification of armed conflict rather than, I like what you said to begin with, giving justification for what we've already done. Let's back up a little bit and say, first of all, there's a history here with Iraq, not just going back to the 91 war, which, by the way, according to military spokespersons, was not finished, but which, interestingly, was considered as just cause by virtually all, unlike the present episode, which finds a strong division. Almost all politically, at least in this country, considered it just cause. Why was that? And then moving forward, after the 91 war, which, according to military spokespersons, was really not finished, consider the fact that there were not 17 UN sanctions which were not carried through by the UN itself. 17 violations of UN sanctions that were not enforced by the UN. I think a legitimate question is, do we allow the UN to run the world and to determine our standards of justice in the world? Are we, in the end, ultimately and only responsible to the UN? What happens if there's genocide? What happens with genocide of part of the Iraqi population, the Kurdish population? What about Rwanda? Where was the UN when, in the mid to early 90s, when Rwanda was about to burst? Conservative estimates, best estimates, would be in the 750,000 to 850,000 with regard to those slaughtered. What about Bosnia Kosovo? I have to ask, as an American, where was Europe in Bosnia Kosovo? Whether or not America should have been involved, where was Europe? That is, in the backyard. Back to Iraq, though. There was a 25-year history of egregious human rights violations in Iraq, which was unparalleled in the Middle East. I mentioned the genocide of at least the Kurdish sector of the Iraqi population. Does that qualify? Is that just cause? Do many people remember, Todd, Israel's preemptive strike in June of 1982 of a nuclear reactor just outside of Baghdad in the city of Osirik. Probably few remember that. Iraq was close at that time, and that's over 20 years ago, to nuclear capabilities. So the whole discussion of were there weapons of mass destruction really is immaterial, because already 20 years ago, at least Israel deemed it necessary to act preemptively in order to avoid chaos in the Middle East. Does anybody remember Scud missiles, or the threat of Scud missiles being launched, which would have carried biological weapons? That's already over 10 years ago, but that's gone. Has anybody paid attention to Iraqi scientists who had done nuclear research and work post-91 war, but pre-2003? I would say, given the threat of Iraq to destabilize the region, given its egregious human rights violations and that record over the last 25 years, and the oppressive nature of the regime, yes, the cause was just, even when I allow for a great latitude in terms of disagreement, whether among the Christian community or among the American public at large.
Dr. Charles, let's lay down some definitions, because you've been there in the course of your answer to that question, operating, it sounds like, with a set of criteria that that kind of define or set the parameters for what
yes.
might be considered a justified war.
Yes.
Let's set that definition for justified war with those criteria.
Good.
What are they typically?
Yes, there are five core criteria that with several ancillary criteria that flow out of those five core that really constitute the heart of the just war tradition. And really, Todd, we're going from the early church fathers up to the present. There is not a fluid, but there is a flexible and yet stable core to the just war tradition. Those criteria, as enunciated by mainstream Christian moral thinkers throughout the ages, divide into two groups, classically known as jus ad bellum, or literally justice going to war, that is to say, whether we should or should not go. And then the second category would be jus in bello, that is, justice in the midst of war, that is to say, how do we proceed with just warfare. The first category, whether we should go or not go, three elements belong to that category: just cause, proper authority, and right intention. Just cause, a nation or people group must be able to identify an injury or injustice inflicted. For example, when a nation invades or annexes its own or another nation or people group or territory, the most basic human rights to sovereignty are then violated. Just cause then wrestles with an appropriate response where gross injustice or moral culpability is established. Proper authority, perhaps the most important factor in the just war thinking of Thomas Aquinas. Consider for a moment the social environment in which he lived, and we can perhaps understand why proper authority was for him most important of those three. There was a constant temptation toward marauding, piracy, banditry, and very often warfare would be enacted as a private enterprise. And so for Thomas, it was very, very important that warfare be placed in the public domain. And this, of course, is the heart of politics, is it not? Proper authority. And then thirdly, right intention. That is to say, unjust war could be best illustrated by what does not constitute right aim or right intention. What would such scenarios be? For example, a sovereign's pride or reputation, national aggrandizement, bloodthirst might be another, cited territorial expansion, that sort of thing. For a war to be just and its aim to be good and the right intention to be identified, a greater good, that is an ordered peace, peace as an ultimate aim. Now, it's interesting in Western culture, and certainly in the American context, Todd, several ancillary criteria flow out of those, but they're not part of the core. The one that we always hear about would be last resort. Last resort joins reasonable chance of success as well as proportionate means and formal declaration of war as what I would call ancillary criteria. That's not to say they're unimportant, but they simply flow out of the first three that I mentioned. And last resort, interestingly, is perhaps the obsession of most people who oppose in any or most forms war and the use of force. And the reason for that simply is, at least for the principled or the ideological pacifist, there can never be exhausted all diplomatic or alternative measures. And the just warrior, that is the person wrestling with what is just, should we or should we not, has to wrestle with what has been reasonable. And I would say reasonable is the operative word there. So last resort should not be elevated to one of the core. It's rather one of the ancillary criteria in among the just war components. And then the second major division, how to proceed in war, the two main ones are discrimination or non-combatant immunity. That is to say, we do not attack innocents, women, children, non-combatants. So justice requires that we not take innocent life. And then the second under that heading would be proportionality. Just war thinking distinguishes itself, say, from the crusade mindset or militarism by its commitment to limit war. So in the just war tradition, force is both permitted but also limited. And of course, our whole criminal justice system, let's just refine it and confine it to the domestic context. Our whole criminal justice system is based on the principle of proportionality, isn't it? That is, we reward crimes according to their magnitude and severity. And of course, any parent knows that too. So the principle, it seems to me, abides at whatever level of life we're looking at. Proportionality would be the second of those two. Those then together constitute the core of the just war tradition.
Now, it seems as though, and you mentioned one of these, I know for sure in your book, two concepts that also need careful definition as we talk about just war. One is the concept of justice itself. And the other that occurs to me is the whole notion of a lesser of two evils. You mentioned a greater good. It's kind of another way of talking about that whole concept. We've had guests on this program who have said, well, okay, war should not be viewed as a good in itself, but it can be and often must be viewed as the necessary lesser of two evils. Can we talk about those two concepts, justice and the lesser of two evils?
Well, in my discussion of justice in the book, I make reference to the South African Supreme Court Justice Richard Goldstone. And I, wherever I travel and in my classes, I always keep these words of his very close by. In a very important address, Todd, in 1997 at the U.S. Holocaust Museum, and I'm hoping that some of your listeners have been there in Washington and visited, Justice Goldstone had these remarks. By the way, Goldstone had previously been chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Tribunals for the former Yugoslavia and Rwanda. He had this to say at the U.S. Holocaust Museum, and I think this bears on your question with regard to justice. He says this: "The one thing I have learned in my travels to the former Yugoslavia and in Rwanda and in my own country," recall, by the way, he's South African, "is that where there have been egregious human rights violations that have been unaccounted for, where there has been no justice," he qualifies this, "where the victims have not received any acknowledgement, where they have been forgotten," that is, the victims, "where there has been a national amnesia, the effect of that is a cancer in society. It is the reason that explains, in my respectful opinion," he continues, "the spirals of violence that the world has seen in the former Yugoslavia for centuries and in Rwanda for decades," just to use two obvious examples. So, he concludes, justice can make a contribution to bringing enduring peace. The context of those comments, of course, recall us to reflect back on the Holocaust. Now, there have been other Holocausts, even in the 20th century. But it seems to me the natural law tradition, that is, what St. Paul describes as the law written in the heart through conscience and the cosmos that allows us to intuit, to discern basic good and evil, is applicable to all people in all cultures. So, for example, what we understand as the Ten Commandments, the Ten Words, these have a universal applicability whether people are religious or not. So basic justice does not only reduce to the lesser of two evils, but but rather justice understands itself as a permitted but measured response to evil that will take into consider various proportions. I noted a few minutes ago the just war criteria that constitute the core. Justice will consider, it will not simply go in and firebomb. We don't firebomb Oklahoma City in order to find and flush out Timothy McVeigh's. Neither did we firebomb Iraq simply to kill Hussein and his sons and those loyal to him. But rather, we go in with discretion. Now, there must be a critical mass reached. And that point at which the critical mass is reached must be deliberated over by politicians and policymakers. And it's my firm conviction that the church, people of goodwill and people of religious faith, need to contribute to that moral discussion. But there comes a point at which then duly elected representatives and governments must make those decisions. And very often the layperson is not privy to what military intelligence or a Senate Foreign Relations Committee reports provide in the way of the geopolitical situation. But that just cause, that proper authority, that right intent be established and then applied, that's a politically prudent act. That is to say, political wisdom is needed to apply these particular criteria. So it's not just a matter of deliberating. It's not weighing, is this a greater evil or is this a lesser evil, but rather, what is just in the face of evil based on our basic definitions of evil? Now, let's face it, we live in a culture which is hesitant or resists naming evil, good and evil. So that complicates the matter. So I don't assume, for example, and this is one of the reasons I wrote the book, I don't assume that American culture is able to determine what is just. Therefore, we have to think with prior ages, prior generations, in working through and revisiting what is basic justice. George Orwell wrote in a very prescient but brief essay shortly before he died in 1950 that when the obvious becomes clouded, we have to restate the obvious. And I think we live in a cultural moment. We live in a post-consensus moral climate, Todd, in which the basics have to be revisited, and that's going to require thinking with prior generations because of our moral obtuseness and our post-consensual cultural climate.
The subject of our conversation during this hour with Dr. Daryl Charles is Just War. He's author of several books, including his latest, Between Pacifism and Jihad, Just War and Christian Tradition. Join us, if you would, with questions or comments on Just War, 1-800-730-2727, or in studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Again, that number, 1-800-730-2727. Is there evidence of just war, the concept, perhaps not in those terms, but the concept prior to the Christian era?
Well, the development of just war thinking among the church fathers, Todd, did not happen in a moral vacuum. I think it's right and it's fair to say that it was given its ultimate expression. But in answer to your question, yes, the idea of justice is intuited by people. If there is this law written in the heart, as Paul writes in Romans 2, then that means that wisdom and justice and basic moral intuitions are the possession of all people. I note in the book, for example, 5th and 6th century philosophers Lao Tzu and Sun Tzu, who articulated in a very, what we would consider primitive form, just war thinking. I also note that the Hindu civilization of India during the 4th century as well, codified in what has been called the Book of Manu, states humanitarian rules that were to regulate warfare that was conducted by honorable warriors. Plato and Aristotle, it should be noted, both view war as a necessary evil. Nevertheless, they also question what is sufficient warrant for going to war. I don't want to bog down your listeners, but it seems to me that the active student of the just war tradition and just war theory would do well to go back and read, for example, in Plato's Republic. the ravaging of enemy territory that is outlawed based on basic just war criteria. Also, in his laws, Plato acknowledges that the only commonwealth that is a properly constituted authority is that which can declare war or peace and be able to justify going to war or not. Perhaps the high point, though, of pagan philosophical reflection on war and peace is found in Stoic philosophy. And even though Stoicism really predates the Christian advent by three centuries, it reaches its peak in the first century. And even 100 years before Paul appeared at Athens, and we find just a preview of that in Acts 17, the Roman Stoic philosopher Cicero developed criteria that would justify going to war or not, as well as Seneca in the first century in Roman legal jurisdiction. So there are quite a few pre-Christian pagan, shall we say, precedents for just war. But that's because justice is something that is intuitive, that is part of the moral fabric of creation, just as wisdom is. When you read the book of Proverbs, one realizes that to be wise and wisdom itself are accessible to all people. Now, that's not to say that wisdom doesn't have its fullest expression in the revelation of Christ. It does. But there are wise people who are not Christians, are there not? There are good people who are not Christians. And so one has to be careful that one does not equate Christian faith necessarily with intuiting justice.
So it sounds like from what you are saying that we live in a day and age where the whole concept of natural law has been called into question legally and philosophically.
Indeed.
And politically. Can there be a coherent notion of just war apart from a firm understanding and belief in natural law?
Well, spoken like a good Lutheran, I tell you. I wish there were more of you around, you know, because I'm a card-carrying member of evangelical Protestantism. I have to lament, and I have to rejoice in your mentioning that, but I have to lament that among most of my brethren, that's virtually non-existent. I did criminal justice research, Todd, in the early to mid-1990s, and working on Capitol Hill, I found myself constantly, and at times solely among Roman Catholics, mm-hmm. and an occasional Lutheran. And the reason for that was, yes, very simply, their historical understanding of Christian social ethics, and at the core of that is understood to be the natural law tradition. But sadly, there's been a lot of misunderstanding that surrounds the natural law tradition, and some of that is of our own doing. For example, the theologian Karl Barth, who was reacting to Nazi totalitarianism, was right and wrong in his consigning natural law theory to that which was outside of God's revelation. Do you see what I'm saying? In other words, everything in National Socialism was ascribed to be of the divine will, and therefore mandated, and therefore to be obeyed. And of course, Barth, along with the others who were faithful, among those Bonhoeffer and members of the Confessing Church, were reacting to that. Unfortunately, that reaction was, shall we say, overdone. And I'm sorry to say that over the last 60 years, most, if not all, of Protestantism, with the exception of some Reformed and Lutheran thinkers.
Let's take a break here, and when we come back, we'll let him finish that thought.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
I am Professor Rick Neufer, and I am the Dean of Assessment at Concordia Theological Seminary. Our seminary strives to be the very best seminary possible for the preparation of pastors and other church workers. Therefore, we have voluntarily subjected ourselves to the high standards of the North Central Association of Colleges and Universities and to the standards of the Association of Theological Schools. The faculty and administration of Concordia Theological Seminary continually assess its programs, curriculum, and teaching methods, all so that we can be the best that we can be and offer our students an excellent education. We take St. Paul's word to Timothy seriously, that pastors should be apt to teach. They must know the faith and be able to articulate it.
For excellence in theological education, call Concordia Theological Seminary, 1-800-481-2155.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. Perceived and actual abuse of the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act has the attention of the U.S. Senate. The law has resulted in Indian tribes establishing gambling casinos on land not related to the tribe. That's caused Arizona Senator John McCain to hold hearings to close loopholes that allow reservation shopping. Bill Wilson was on hand.
Senator McCain says Indian tribes are trying to use exceptions in the law to establish gambling casinos by shopping for land outside their reservations.
In recent years, this committee has been made aware of attempts by some tribes and by some non-Indian developers to expand the use of these exceptions in ways not contemplated when IGRA was enacted.
But Bureau of Indian Affairs Deputy Secretary George Scabeen insists there's no problem.
Essentially, we've had not that many applications. They have been carefully considered. As you can see from the record, it hasn't been a runaway problem of Indian tribes seeking lands off reservation.
Ohio Senator George Voinovich disagrees. He says an Indian tribe in Ohio made a court claim for 4 million acres, an area the size of Cleveland and Cincinnati combined, and would only drop the claim if a gambling casino was approved.
This has become a gigantic shell game. Instead of righting earlier wrongs against tribes, we are no longer looking at giving tribes the self-sufficiency needed for economic gain, but rather lining the pockets of investors with large sums of money.
There seems to be a disconnect between senators and the Bureau of Indian Affairs that should result in changing the law. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bill Wilson in Washington.
The Senate is holding hearings before it offers legislation to correct problems in the act. Several amendments have already been offered to make it harder for Indian tribes to put gambling casinos on previously non-reservation lands. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
Always good to get a young man's perspective on ministry and the church on the Bible study, and that's what we'll do next time as we do an Ask the Pastor program with our good friend, Pastor Joe Cox. He'll be our guest next time on the Bible study, and you can ask the pastor. Listen to the Bible study, weekday mornings at 10:05. Join us next time.
The Bible study on AM 850 KFUO is underwritten by Concordia Christian Books and Gifts, serving God's people.
You know, it's possible to read an excerpt of our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for July on our website, issuesetc.org. It's titled, Handling the Word of Truth, Law and Gospel in the Church Today. More information is available from Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. The cost is $12.99 plus shipping and handling. Handling the Word of Truth by Pastor John Pless, our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for July.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about just war. Dr. Darrell Charles is our guest. He's Associate Professor of Religion and Ethics at Union University in Jackson, Tennessee, and he's author of several books, including his latest, Between Pacifism and Jihad, Just War and Christian Tradition. Feel free to join us with a question or a comment, 1-800-730-2727, or our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org, 1-800-730-2727, or issuesetc@kfuo.org. Listeners with the best questions or comments will get a copy of this new book entitled Between Pacifism and Jihad by our guest, Dr. Darrell Charles. Dr. Charles, we had to cut you off there at the break a little bit. It sounds like you were saying that for the most part nowadays, the notion of natural law as the foundation for just war thinking has been abandoned, as you said, with the exception of just very few.
Yes, indeed. Do you recall, certainly many of your listeners recall, the Clarence Thomas hearing?
Oh, yes.
Back 14 years ago or thereabout. And Senator Joseph Biden of Delaware, of course, took the opportunity to lecture not only Judge Thomas, but all of us as well, on what was a proper and improper understanding of natural law. And, of course, Biden, as well as most of contemporary culture, has been schooled in the idea that natural law is basically that which it's bleached of any moral considerations. And this is what Thomas was trying to argue delicately as he did, at least in the hearings. That is, all law has a moral foundation. Well, that assumption that you and I, you know, assume, which is non-controversial, is a scandal for our secular counterparts. But law ultimately has a theological foundation. And, of course, for the Christian and for the Judeo-Christian adherent, law is rooted in the very foundations of creation. So all of law has moral underpinnings. Now, that's not to say that all of positive law, which is to say law enacted by humans, by governments, is always just. It means that, in fact, natural law shows us, certain laws, some legality is, in fact, unjust. It was interesting that out of the World War II era, in the 30s and 40s, there were a number of European legal theorists who came to the States then, who ended up teaching here at prestigious universities. They either fled Nazi Germany or satellites of Germany, and they wrote, they ended up writing quite a bit on natural law. That was a reaction to a prostituted understanding of nature and quote-unquote natural theology. What I wanted to say, and by the way, Todd, I come out of a Mennonite tradition. I'm not today Mennonite or Anabaptist out of conviction, but I grew up in an Anabaptist home, and so I'm appreciative of Anabaptist presuppositions. There is a deep Protestant bias against natural law. Not only, as I mentioned before, Karl Barth, who was, again, reacting to Nazi and National Socialist ideology, but you have also theologians and ethicists closer to our time. I'm thinking of, for example, Paul Lehmann, one or two generations removed, known for his Koinonia Christian ethic. A little bit closer, John Howard Yoder, who comes out of the Mennonite tradition, who taught for 30-plus years at Notre Dame and who died several years ago. John Howard Yoder has exercised an enormous influence in terms of theology and ethics, not just among Mennonites, but among Protestants in general. As a pacifist, Yoder argued basically and assumed that government is always and inherently evil, and therefore, consistent with his radical Anabaptist forebears, we need to absolutely separate us. But closer to home today, you have people like Stanley Hauerwas, the very entertaining and very popular ethics professor at Duke, who's a very popular conference speaker, who is absolutely opposed to natural law, and it continues really the legacy of Yoder. What joins all of these theologians and ethicists is a commitment to what I would call a Christological ethics, that is, as opposed to a creational ethics, in contrast with Lutheran and Reformed thought. A Christological ethics views redemption only in terms of the new covenant and fails to see God's eternal and abiding ethical standard. And the result, unhappily, is that Protestants today, unlike Roman Catholics in the main, Protestants, unhappily, lack a moral grammar and the wherewithal to enter responsive debate in the public square. So evangelicals, maybe, who are well-meaning, get out there, and they only have a religious language, and that language is the language of faith, salvation, and justification. They're unable to deal with pluralists and secularists because it's a different grammar, it's a different way of thinking. And over the years, my own thinking has been shaped and formed by Paul's example in Acts 17 when he visited Athens, and I believe there's something paradigmatic there. There, Paul combines general revelation with special revelation as he witnesses to the Athenians. Athens, of course, at this time, mid-first century, is pre-Christian. The gospel has not come yet. And so how does he meet them? He meets them at their own level. And how does he do that, Todd? He does it through natural law thinking. If we read the text there of his address to the Council of the Areopagus, that is Mars Hill, we find him using categories of natural law, nature, the cosmos. He uses typically Stoic categories. These would have been the people in his audience. So he utilizes general revelation in order to meet them where they're at, in order to take advantage of common ground. Now, he doesn't stay there. He doesn't stop there. And, of course, the typical evangelical is worried, well, general revelation doesn't save. Oh, Christ is sufficient. Well, that's true. However, Paul turns the corner. He uses general revelation to set them up, to gain his audience, and to minister to them at their level. Then he turns the corner and introduces special revelation, that is, the God-man, Jesus Christ, who one day will judge you. The times of ignorance, he preaches, are now over. God does not wink at our ignorance, but rather he will judge you on this coming day of reckoning. Now, Luke is summarizing in a very brief way there that speech, and so he doesn't perhaps do justice to everything. But one gets a tantalizing taste of what of Paul's strategy, and I like that. And the reason I like that is this. Today, Western culture might be considered post-consensus or post-Christian and pagan. Athens, I would say, would be pre-Christian but pagan. And perhaps there are more touch points between Athens of mid-first century and Western culture today than we've considered. So in a post-consensus or a post-Christian context, we must utilize, I believe, as St. Paul did in Athens, the grammar and the logic of natural law. We don't just end there, but I think we have to begin there. And in a pagan cultural context, which doesn't care about your Jesus, which doesn't care about the authority of Scripture, we have to back up and start at square one. Now, you know, will people morally reason with us? Some will, but some won't. But in order to be faithful, I think we have to meet people where we're at. That, by the way, is not compromising the gospel. That's not compromising strong Christology or justification by faith. It is only meeting pagans where they are at. And I read that when as good Christian apologetics.
You present in the book, and correct me if I'm wrong, but on the subject of terrorism, you present it, the rationale of the terrorist, as almost the negative mirror image of just war thinking. If compared point for point on the criterion
yes.
that we mentioned early on,
yes.
you say that the terrorist pretty much comes up on the opposite side on every one of these issues, just cause,
yes.
Right authority, right intent, all the way down the line. Talk about terrorism as a foil, I don't can't think of a better word, to just war thinking.
Yes. Uh-huh. Well, the reason I included a chapter in the book on terrorism was very often the question is raised, well, you know, just war, that's great for the past, but what about terrorism today? We live in a new era. Todd, many people thought that with the collapse of the Soviet Empire and the fall of the Iron Curtain, that the question of military urgency and armed conflict was passed, and that it was an issue lacking urgency. I would argue, and I do so, at least I try to in the book, that it is precisely since 1990 that, and the geopolitical events since the end of the Cold War that call forth the urgency for us to reconsider the moral, the merits and the moral substructure of armed conflict. Not because I'm a militarist. No, I actually grew up in an Anabaptist home, as I said, but because we must wrestle with the qualifications of justice. I want to say, too, I alluded a few minutes ago that in the early and mid-90s I did criminal justice research in Washington, and one of the things that I was exposed to again and again was the absence of thoughtful Christians working toward justice in the realm of policy. Perhaps it's not true of Lutherans and Reformed people in general, but broader Protestant evangelicalism has tended to develop a dichotomy between the secular and sacred. And for them, that priority means we witness, we evangelize, we concern ourselves with the spiritual and with the soul, narrowly construed, and maybe we discover the social implications of our faith. Maybe we wrestle with how to bring faith in the marketplace, but most of us sort of endure our work and then look forward to real ministry, either on weekends or in church work or what have you. But to the reformers, work, a vocation was, and any vocation was our calling and a noble calling before God. And that included, by the way, soldiering as well as being a government leader. So I think that very often Christians and Protestant conservatives have a very negative view of government. Now, that translates into problems when we're called then to work for justice. I mean, after all, that's not evangelism, is it? Or thwart terrorism. And then that's the problem is compounded by the lack of moral education and moral formation in most of our circles. And I'm not just speaking of teaching and preaching in the average congregation, but even at the seminary level, very often our pastors are not equipped with any sort of training in Christian social ethics so that they can go out and train their congregants. Now, back to your question about terrorism. Very often the question is raised, well, what about terrorism? This is something new. How in the world could just war be applied to that? And I would respond, and the chapter basically tries to make this argument. While terrorism takes on a new form today through resurgent Islam, it is not a new phenomenon. I think, for example, of Thomas Aquinas. I mentioned earlier in the program that Thomas enunciated among the three core criteria of just cause, legitimate authority, and right intent. Authority for him was the most important of those. Why was that? Well, because it was the fear of chaos and disorder in his own day. Very common was marauding, piracy, banditry. That is to say, warfare was enacted in the private realm for private reasons. And for Thomas, then, warfare had to be lifted and placed into the public domain. Now, you mentioned that it seems like terrorism is the opposite reflection of just war criteria. And that's why, yes, I believe that the just war tradition speaks to terrorism so directly. Consider just cause, for example. What is just? Consider indiscriminate, that I mentioned earlier, non-combatant immunity is one of the core criteria of how we proceed. Terrorism, of course, is horribly indiscriminate. That is to say, innocents are not spared at all. Proportionality. Terrorism very deliberately is disproportionate in order to evoke shock. And there is great, anyone who has studied terrorists and crime understands the psychological factor in the terrorist threat. Now, let me make an analogy, and herewith I'll conclude. How would we handle crime with the mafia? Very often the objection or the concern is with terrorists, well, these people are not a nation. It is either subnational or supranational. How can we go after these people? After all, they're not a legitimate sovereignty. To which I would respond, how do we deal with crime when it's, say, gang-related? How do we deal with the mafia? Do we not seek to enact justice? Do we not try to inhibit crime if it's mafia-related because it's subnational? It's in L.A. and New York and Las Vegas and Chicago. Or when it's supranational, that is, it's here and there. But it's also in Sicily, in Melbourne, in Munich, and so on. And so it seems to me moral cowardice says, oh, we don't want to work for justice and try to inhibit evil because of the kickback. Now, few people would say that. No, that's moral cowardice. We have to work for justice. And we marshal everything in law enforcement, in military intelligence, and diplomacy, and government. We marshal everything for the sake of justice. I would say the analogy holds up with regard to terrorism. And that itself qualifies by definition because it is sub or at times supranational. But we simply apply the criteria because of its gross violation of those basic tenets of justice.
Folks, we'll open up our phone lines here and take your email and your calls for the last 10 minutes of our conversation on Just War with Dr. Daryl Charles. Our call-in number, 1-800-730-2727, and our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Dr. Daryl Charles is Associate Professor of Religion and Ethics at Union University in Jackson, Tennessee, and author of several books, including his latest, Between Pacifism and Jihad, Just War and Christian Tradition. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. Dr. Charles, is just war theory in danger? We've talked a bit about it being abandoned for various reasons, but is it in danger of being perverted into something that it isn't by the multiplication of these criteria beyond what natural law would dictate? In other words, you said that the pacifist will say last resort is his favorite criteria in the just war theory because, of course, in the pacifist mindset, you never get to a last resort.
Right. Well, there is an important subsection in the book which deals with the presumption against force or war as opposed to the presumption against injustice. And I find, Todd, there is great confusion on this issue. Again, I come out of a pacifist Anabaptist tradition, and so I understand it a bit. My own father was a conscientious objector during World War II. He served in a veterans hospital for several years in the way of alternative service, for which I respect him greatly. So I understand a bit of the tradition, but I find a confusion, shall we say, a conflation very frequently, and it is this all-consuming commitment to peace at any price. And I see that, recall the title of the book, there are two distortions. That is to say, there are two absolute positions, at least ideologically. Militarism or jihad or crusade mindset on the one side, which eschews, it disdains moral reasoning and any sort of moral considerations. That is to be avoided. But, you know, that surfaces again and again in various contexts, whether it's religious or non-religious. On the other end, you have the pure or principled pacifist position, which believes that any force going to war in any situation is immoral, and that force can never be marshaled for just purposes. Between pacifism and jihad, the implication is that there is a position, and this is the mainstream Christian moral tradition, and so I want to simply align myself with that. Throughout the centuries, mainstream Christian moral thinkers have argued that no, there is not simply, there are not two alternatives, but rather we must work in this, what I would call, messy middle. That is, we must roll up our sleeves and work for justice. Hugo Grotius, who lived in the 17th century, who was considered really the father of international law, very committed Christian, who lived at a time of the 30 Years' War, and thus saw the havoc that war created there in virtually all of Europe. You would think he would have been a very strong, committed pacifist, but his position was, we should not say that nothing is ever permitted, and we should not also say that everything is always tolerated, but rather we must work, we must use discretion, we must use wisdom, we must apply force in the face of evil. People, I find very often today, tend to, you know, we react to the God and country types, to the jihadists, but in our culture, I'm struck by how strong, particularly in the academy, maybe not in the congregations and not in the pews, but in the academy, how pervasively strong a commitment to pacifism is. And in the book, in this particular section that I mentioned, I cite the many statements on peace that were issued by Protestant denominations in the 1980s, that is, at really the height of the Cold War. And the one that I note in particular is the statement that was published in 1983 by the U.S. Catholic bishops. It was titled The Challenge of Peace. And it seemed, Todd, as if the bishops wanted to have it both ways in this particular statement. That is, they had this all-consuming commitment to peace, yet they just stopped short of saying there may be situations in which we would have to use force. And the problem I often encounter is that the peace that people desire, religious or non-religious, is very often unqualified. Peace is not legitimate if it's not ordered. And so always justice has priority over peace. That is to say, peace can be legitimate or illegitimate. A peace can be just or unjust. And so peace must be ordered. Augustine spoke of this as the tranquillitas ordinis, that is to say, literally, a justly ordered peace. Civil society needs a peace that is justly ordered. Tyranny, oppression, totalitarianism is characterized by a peace, but it can be an unjust peace. And so the just war thinker wrestles with a tension between these polar opposites, these polar ideological opposites, and realizes, just as in the criminal justice system, I remind people who have a hard time with the thesis of the book or my position, there are not simply two alternatives to crime. We do not simply passively let heinous crime happen, nor do we, on the other hand, simply acquiesce to police brutality. There are not two options. There is a middle way. That is to say, we reject both extremes, and we have to work for justice, which is to say we have to apply, we have to wrestle with the application of justice. It is both permitted, however, it must be limited. That's the heart of the just war tradition, and I believe it applies both to domestic as well as foreign policy.
Folks, here's our mailing address. It's Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Here's our resource line number. It is 1-800-737-0172. Now, you can use either of those, our address or our resource line number, to receive a free complimentary copy of our next Issues Etc. journal, or to help support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. by making a tax-deductible gift. The address again, Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117, or our resource line number, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. Dr. Darrell Charles is Associate Professor of Religion and Ethics at Union University in Jackson, Tennessee, and author of several books, including his latest, Between Pacifism and Jihad, Just War and Christian Tradition. Dr. Charles, it has been a tremendous pleasure and very interesting. Thank you for being our guest.
Oh, it's been my delight. Thank you for having me on the program.
You know, I started our conversation with Dr. Charles by mentioning those two bumper stickers I saw driving in yesterday. One that said, "War is never the answer." And the other one, just a couple cars later, said, "If war is the answer, we're asking the wrong question." Wouldn't it be nice if that was true? But it isn't. You know, the greatest insight into just war is that there are wars that are not in service of justice and therefore not justified. But that realization can only be maintained if we say also at the same time there are wars that are in this world justified, and that, yes, sometimes war is not the ultimate answer, but an intermediate answer to injustice. You've seen the other one, haven't you? No justice, no peace, and no peace, no justice, as though somehow if we simply maintain a non-warlike atmosphere, if we simply have peace, then we will have justice. Well, that's not necessarily true. The absence of war may be peaceful, in fact, but it may allow, as Dr. Charles so well put it at the end of our conversation, may allow injustice to reign unfettered. God has given to us in the realm of reason and law and common sense the use of force. And that use of force is to be used as everything our God and Creator has given us. It should be used to the same end, to serve our neighbor, to protect our neighbor, to help our neighbor when he is at the wrong end of someone else, our neighbor, to defend him, seek his good, and never do him harm, even if that means going to war. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues Etc., please visit the audio archive section at KFUO.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM 850 KFUO. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.